Okay, there we go.
So last week, week one of the unit, we talked about embodiment theory in general. Week two, we got into sort of how might we look at patients' bodies as they experience illness. How does a patient body change? It's sort of the phenomenology of chronic pain. This week, we're going to look at that same body, that embodied ill body, as and how it presents itself to others. So last week was sort of, you know, how is it experienced internally? This week is this idea that patients are also storytellers, visually, verbally, written. How your view of your body and how you're so... how your body has changed, how your view of yourself has changed, and then how those changes get expressed and how you interact with the world through the form of stories. We're only going to focus really on three, and I apologize for that error. I don't know why I threw up that random Radley article, which is really good since you so happen to want to read it, but I don't know. And so I uploaded the Frank piece in time. So we're going to focus on the Chambers... The Frank chapter, and what's her name? Lawrence. Those three. So focusing in on those three, I kind of wanted to just get a sense from the group, as you were reading for this week, what were some of the themes that popped up for you that relate to all of these pieces and in the unit?
This might be too general a statement.
You should see my list.
But essentially, it was. I kept getting the impression that these were people that really want to be heard, and I often got taken back to the TV show, you know, that's still on History Diagnosis, where people are kind of just almost imploring to, hey, hear my story here. I'm not just this research project. I'm not just this. And it was very much a. These are people that just want to be heard. That's what I keep going back to. At the same time, though, just relating to relatives of my family that have had strange illnesses, you know, there's also that, I almost felt that there was a generational thing, you know, meaning that certain folks of a certain age don't feel comfortable talking about what is actually affecting them in a personal manner. And it's almost like they're still kind of bowing at the feet of the physician. You know, let the physician tell me what's wrong, diagnose me, cure me, whatever.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Those were neither simple. Neither of those were simple points. Thank you. I think I'm going to put a deadline on any and all hedging. It has to end by next week. Yeah, Sylvie.
I was going to say, a general theme I picked up was just this idea of bodies being invisible and giving authority back to the patient via giving them a voice, whether that's through narration or art or some medium where they can sort of communicate their experience of their body.
Cool. Yeah, Lauren.
As we get further into this, I'm starting to look at the patient and how we look at the body specimen, and to think that it's not just people that have been ill, it's kind of everyone, because when you have a parent or a friend that dies or has an illness, it affects you the same way, and I don't think there's a single human on earth that hasn't had that happen. So as we stigmatize these people and otherize them, it's really broader of a statement on all of humanity. And when talking about stories and whatnot with the internet and Facebook and stuff, it gives people a platform. So I was wondering, when you talk about technology and the legs, are you really trying to make a bigger statement about cameras, or is it really actually about cameras and brain scans? Or is it the internet's this big data is everything, a picture of our identity?
Meaning, so I think no, a brain scan is never just a brain scan. Or what we've talked about in terms of visually mediated technological ways of viewing in the body.
Yeah,
You're right. They could be adapted to just...
You can know more about their brain than you can from seeing them, like, seeing them every day.
Say that last sentence again. You can know more about them by a brain scan than by...
If you had access to someone's emails and Google searches and everything they've done on the internet, that's a picture of inside their brain, and that combined with a picture of their brain,
it's... Interesting. Slightly too far afield for right now.
Okay.
You and Tony need to talk, because that's what Tony's fascinated by and writes about a lot. Fun to think with, but we need to keep it in the form of patienthood, which is an interesting project. In fact, Lance Whalert is doing a course next fall, just got added to the roster, Medicine and Technology, sort of how focusing on social, or is it medicine and social media, something like that. So I'm sure he'll talk about things like that. So regardless of whether or not we could make the similar arguments for everyone, let's focus it on it back on patients and the themes of an almost visceral need to tell stories, the empowerment that is either taken or given through the telling of stories. What other themes that emerge from these readings did people gravitate towards?
So one thing I kind of got was, I guess best described by the Frank article, kind of how humans have been moving more towards a view of the body. So in pre-modern times, it was just, I have a body, I'm sick. And then doctors got to look at the body and say, well, your body's sick, this way. And now people are stepping kind of outside of themselves and documenting their own bodies and how their bodies are sick and their experiences through that. So just kind of more objectifying illness and the experience of it. Not necessarily objectifying it, but stepping out of it and observing it.
Sure. A hyper, reclaiming it, the subjective in the person. Not really relevant, but more of a tangent point. I'm not sure that he's making the argument, and we'll talk about this in a few minutes, that the sort of pre-modern was just, I have a body, I'm sick, that's it. I think what makes that interesting and why it's not that way is because you think sort of pre-modern, smaller scale societies, much more interdependent, much more community-based, still with some hierarchies, of course, et cetera, but there's a much more cohesiveness to it where everyone, there's less variation, I think, within small scale societies than there is in a post-modern, globalized world. So I think part of some of the things that postmodernism is doing for individuals with this telling of the story was built into the fabric of culture in the pre-modern. Still trying to make sense of it, trying to have a voice, trying to be empowered through experiences. But there were much more unconscious ways to do it because it was just that's the way it was done. I'd have to go back to some of my early medical anthropology and pre-industrialized societies to fully support that, but I'm pretty sure that that's what they would say.
Well, he didn't talk very much about pre-modern at all. I guess he summed it up when he just said, in the pre-modern world, folks didn't know what illness was. They just went to bed and died.
Yeah, I don't even know if I like that sentence. Because what that is implying is that they don't know what they died based on what we know about how they died, whether it be cancer or anything else like that. I don't think anybody gets sick and says, you just have to make it up. Okay. I think, yes. I told you my list was basic. Let's not forget that one of the key themes is actually stories, because that's going to play a big role when we talk about narrative theory at the end, is that these are not just sort of carbon copies of experience or not transcriptions of experience. They're stories with a particular genre, with a particular intended audience and unintended audiences, frameworks, expectations, that sort of thing. This idea of voice and sort of reclaiming of a voice, of who gets to be the protagonist of, not just the protagonist of the story, but who gets to write the story and whose voice shines through. And these things apply whether or not we're listening, looking, or witnessing. We'll talk about witnessing at the end, which is one of my favorites. It's like I've become fascinated with this ethical witnessing. And the way in which power relations are interwoven throughout the stories. And not just power relations that we typically understand them, you know, sort of the way, you know, there's a practitioner or an institution and there's a patient and they're unequal power relationships. But it's also power in the face of illness, power with different parts of the body, the old body versus the new body versus the body we're turning into, power relationships between, or power, not relationships, but the theme of power between author and listener and viewer, the situatedness in context of the players in the storytelling, both within the story as well as in the act of story, that it infuses all of those elements. Yes, Tila.
So my thoughts are not fully formulated, but the notion of giving voice, which is, I think what we think is that there's a need for people with illness to voice their experiences and their, to voice their experiences. In social movements, the notion of giving voice is a fundamental aspect of social movements. And we can definitely see it in the psychiatric survivors movement, where the individual stories compiled into basically a movement of giving voice to the individual stories of oppression of people with psychiatric disabilities was one of the most fundamental aspects of that movement, especially for that movement, because mm-hmm. We can contrast giving voice to silence. Mm-hmm. And empowerment versus oppression. It's not fully formulated, but the personal is political.
Oh yeah.
That's.
I like your connection though to social movements, and it ties into this odd sense of optimism I've been having lately too, and sort of give me a basis for having some sort of optimism. One tweak of language though is, I'm not sure I like giving voice. I think taking voice, given the fact of how we're going to talk about this, might be a better way to think about it. Because giving voice implies that it's mine to give you.
But a movement does do that. A social movement does give voice to their members. Yes.
Yeah, ideally because the voice has been demanded. You know, it's one thing to knock on someone's door and yell at the door, you know, versus another thing to invite somebody into your home to talk.
True, but the power of a movement is the ability to give voice, not just on the individual level, but in a larger way. I think another mm-hmm. larger effect.
It's like a chicken or the egg kind of thing. Like, does the movement come first, which the voice is, you know, taken, is able to be given? Kind of thing?
Or taken in a space.
Or do the people come together and take, you know, the movement and the voice of it. So, you know.
Who can then turn it around and give it to those who need to have it, who then turn around and give it to...
Right.
Okay.
I'm not sure I fully agree, because I think social movements start with individual voices that...
That have been taken. That have not been given.
I'm not arguing with you.
These are called hidden transcripts, right?
What?
Hidden transcripts.
What do you mean?
James Scott's Omniscient and the Art of Resistance. I'm trying to find a place that describes this, but collectively, like stories of being passed, of slaves, of patients, of poor people.
Oh, and if you find something later, send it to me. Yeah. I'm not familiar. Okay. I got sidetracked by the giving and taking. But I, yes, appreciate the comment about social movements. And that's it. Well, we'll see what Frank has to say about that later. Why is all of this important? Why should we and I really mean this in a general sense, because obviously we're only, you know, well, actually now we're 20 minutes into class. Okay, I thought we were 10. We're early on in the introductory period of class. Why is paying attention to patient stories necessary? On a very practical level. Because I think we all probably in the back of our heads say, oh, it's, you know, it's respect, it's ethics, it's empowerment.
The process of interviewing diagnosis. I mean, the process of... Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first action.
Mm-hmm. So yes, it's that. It's not. It's for better care, obviously. But it's also, and this is where it's sort of the problem comes in, using attention to stories, again, not just using particular stories, but using the attention to stories to help develop better patient-centered policies and practices. Should we all agree that patient-centered practices and policies are appropriate, which, for the sake of today, let's just lay that one on the table and I'll stipulate to it. Okay, so telling stories. I like the Frank piece a lot, and the whole book is fantastic. So I write, if you liked that chapter one, it's a good book to pick up. Starts by saying that serious illness is a loss of both the destination and of the map. We talk about sort of how the beauty of metaphors, and that. In the similar way that Byron Good talked about last week with the symbolization and the narrativization. Remember that? What is symbolization? Because these are key. Symbolization.
How and the when? Or, yeah.
Yeah.
The how and the when.
The how and the when.
Yes.
Yes, it's sort of that point of diagnosis. Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So then what is narrativization?
The story. The why me.
Mm-hmm. Why now? Why not them?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that narrativization is how you make sense of the moment of symbolization. So, similar point. Telling stories is part of that process of remapping. I'm just using a different metaphor. Key is that they're not stories about illness. Chambers talks about this as well. I love where he sort of does that sort of imagery of a Cartesian head existing separate from the ill body. It's not the head. If you think about only paying attention to stories about illness, that's what you're doing, he says. You're sort of like this Cartesian head, just sort of observing and just describing the body below it. What you want to think about are how stories work through an ill body, how they are told through the entire embodied patient. They're not stories about illness, they're stories through illness. Related to this idea of embodied ethics that we have been talking about. He says that stories through illness take a completely different type of attention than stories about illness. Stories about illness are easy on some level. Stories through illness are harder. And they have, one of the reasons that it's sort of harder to think about them is that they have this both personal and social component. Although, construction is everything has a social, but we'll focus on that here. On a personal level, it's giving voice, as he said, or does he say giving voice to the body? Which I love this. He says, sort of a body in pain is inarticulate in words, although it is very articulate in symptoms and pain. Whereas the social task is more multi-layered. There's the obvious level of, I'm telling a story to someone else. He says, even a message in a bottle implies an audience. But more than that, is it the shape, the form, the nuance, the style, the rationale, all of those aspects of the story are also social aspects. They're artifacts of the social. He says we spend a lifetime listening to others tell illness stories. we spend a lot of time, hopefully less time, telling our own illness stories in different settings and sort of observing how they're responded to, what type of questions people ask. We have the experience of illness stories in popular culture, which we'll start talking about next week. It's this idea of, it's social constructionism of illness stories. That new stories go back into the social pot, which then influence the stories that are told subsequently. It's the slinking. So he says, thinking about social constructionism in the, when we're talking about looking at stories through illness, or bodies, ill bodies telling stories, is that a social constructionist perspective does allow us to connect the individual to the social, because of that, all that embedded nature of culture that we talked about, shared theories, general beliefs. But the problem is when we treat that underlying socialness as a pre-existing pot that just sort of sits there. He really wants us to focus on the formative properties of storytelling. You know, that as new types of stories are told, those new forms, those new rationales, those new metaphors get thrown into the cultural pot, starting a social movement, you know, or something like this, whereas other people can then pull from those stories, those forms and modes of storytelling in their own stories, because it's now part of the baseline. So that rhetoric and telling stories is a productive act, not just a reflective act. We talked last week or the week before about how on an individual level it is sort of productive of the self, you know, because in the act of telling or showing, we are also changing ourselves in that way. But what he's taken that one step further and adding it into the sort of cultural soup in which we're all embedded. Mind does not rest above the body, but is diffused throughout it.
I think it means that there's no separation between the intellect and the body, between right. The story and the body.
Mm-hmm. Which hopefully, if I did my job well enough through last week's embodiment and the week before's lecture, we should all be like, yes. The body is interrelated, and then should you so choose to go into neurophysics or whatever, then you could actually study how that happens neurologically, should you so choose. Okay, so here's where he sort of gets this idea of story, and it's I like the fact that he just admits this. He says, I don't really have any hard data on this, but the illness experience and how it's represented today feels different. I mean, he does sort of have a... I mean, how long have chronic illness has been around? I mean, from the point that we could actually keep you alive with a chronic illness. So it's not that long in the grand scheme of things. So there's one sort of thing that's actually different. But given the fact that we're talking about the interrelatedness of culture, we can't just focus on that. There's other things happening in society. So he lays out, and I think he does a very careful job, so I will reiterate it, that he's not saying these are distinct periods with distinct starts and stops. But there is a overlapping of phases, he calls them. Those are the pre-modern, the modern, and the post-modern. And he says the transitions between the phases are like intercontinental journeys, that the experience remains the same. You know, this is sort of that Kleinman-esque division between the biology and the physiology and the social experience of an illness. The biology and the physiology relatively remains the same. But it gets a new identity as it travels to different continents. So there's an identity of illness that happens in a pre-modern time. There's an identity of illness in the modern era. And there's a new post-modern-esque identity of illness. We're giving new meaning to old actions, is sort of how he says, using that analogy of intercontinental travel. The example he gives, and he doesn't spend a lot of time on pre-modern, he just sort of goes right to the pre-modern-modern transition, is a woman, unfortunately I'm blanking now on where she is. I think
she's in Africa. Africa.
Yeah. I always just hate to say Africa though.
Northern Africa.
Okay. I feel a little bit about that. And she says, in the old days, folk didn't know what illness was. They went to bed and they died. It's only nowadays that we've learned words like liver, lung, stomach, and I don't know what. What is the point that he's making with using this quote? And he says also the very distinct point that he's not making.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think to localize illness and not make just you're sick, but to understand what part of you is sick is different. Maybe she's even referring to the fact that we just knew we were sick. We didn't know we had two lungs and a heart and kidneys and what they did and what their functions were. So that's what I think she was saying, that people were sick, they went to bed, they died. We didn't know they died because their liver had ceased to function or that they had a lung infection or... Now we know that these parts exist. Now there's more knowledge, more meaning. Mm-hmm. And I took her saying is we don't know what to do with this. It was easier when we just knew mom was sick, make her comfortable, and see what happened. The whole I guess the idea I got from it was that knowledge is power, but there's also a burden to knowledge. And that almost adds more levels of responsibility and requirements for action.
Mm-hmm. I like what you're saying, but I need to qualify it with adjectives. Those of you who know me, do you know sort of what I'm thinking here? I always like to do this test every once in a while, because somebody usually does.
Adjective.
Or different nouns. No, the verbs were good. And I'm not sure there were adverbs, so I think we're okay.
I think that he was saying that back in the day there was the experience of being sick, but there wasn't a separate story of being sick. And then, when you compare that with the modern world, all of a sudden there was still the experience of being sick, but then there was this story put in medical records of the illness. So back then, it was just a comprehensive experience of, you just go to bed and die. That was the experience of it.
Okay, I just hearing it that way, and I don't think you actually believe this, but it makes me a little nervous that we're thinking of these pre-modern people, and again, not pre-modern because all the civilizations of pre-modern people have died out, but just because they're not industrialized places. Really just wander around and go, I don't feel well. No. But I think it's why it's so hard to give other nouns and adjectives is because that's our worldview. So this idea that we now know the truth of what's wrong with us, we have this objective knowledge, we have more facts, makes it harder. That's not the key here. Yes.
I think what you're trying to say too is because that's the language didn't exist, and therefore the concepts behind what being sick didn't exist, and you're sick or I feel sick, that wasn't what the experience was. The experience was whatever it is, the experience actually was for whoever was experiencing it. In the pre-modern time, so
explained in local terms,
right? Or that fit the context of the time and place they were in, right?
Yes. As opposed to
yeah.
Oh, I was going to finish it.
Oh,
I'm sorry. I didn't want to finish it.
Okay. Well, we'll see. We'll circle back eventually. Yeah.
Jeff. Well, he says overtly that this quotation is an overlap of the pre-modern, modern, and post-modern. So it's this kind of out of time synthesis, or between all these different time synthesis of a woman who perhaps, maybe not, lives in a culture that doesn't have a lot of technology or whatever. Let's not even assume that.
Are we dancing on the topic? Why are we not calling it sort of this Western biomedicine?
Okay.
I think we can call it that.
Okay.
Okay, keep going.
No, I'm just saying that, I mean, this quotation seems to be like referencing this, the synthesis of all these things, or the recognition of the synthesis of the recognition of all these things going on at once. So, like, well, I don't want to keep reiterating what people are saying about, like, you know, getting sick and just dying, but there was that. I mean, it's bleeding and things like that to cure people. Versus now we know, like, you know, or the modern would know that there's...
I realize sometimes my emotions are on my face too heavily.
Maybe you can probably finish that better.
Are we going with this?
Kind of.
Okay.
I mean, pre-modern wasn't, like, that long ago. Like, SIDS, we still don't have a story to put with SIDS. Like, you wake up, your baby's dead. It's like, we just don't know. There's no words to describe it. There's no backstory to that. So I don't think it's us saying these cultures are dumb or otherworldly. I mean, there are still experiences like that within modern Western medicine.
And we know how problematic that is when we don't have an explanation in the terms that we expect that explanation to be in.
Yes.
Imagine if everything were like that. We would need some sort of pre-modern DSM to help us all figure out why we were so crazy. I guess I really just... Because I am such a cultural relativist, the key here is, she says, and he even says, I don't think she meant that they just went to bed and died and didn't think about it or didn't know what it was. It's just now that there is a imposed, more powerful system of explaining the body, that come with words like liver, lung, stomach, and I don't know what, that is a disembodying experience for people in this transitionary period. So that really is the crux. The crux comes from explanatory models that come from within the culture, that are integrated, that may have to do with spirits, may have to do with environmental changes or just knowledge of bad food and, you know, or spoiled food or dangerous things. I don't know. But it doesn't matter. Because what matters is it internally makes sense with an internal explanatory framework. What makes the transition from the postmodern, from the pre-modern to the modern, is this sense of imposed structure. Yeah, Olivia.
I was just thinking about, this is what it always boils down to, like the early, like midwifery, and how they were sort of granny midwives, that they were just sort of grandmother figures. So, like, medicine wasn't something that, you know, this outside expert did. It was, you know, it was cooking. It was what your mother did when you were sick, or what your grandmother taught you when, you know, how to dress the food. So it was just something that you did. You just went to bed and, you know.
Right. But it wasn't willy-nilly. It was based on lifetimes of experience and storytelling. Right.
And it was treatment, but it wasn't called this other thing. Mm-hmm. It was just called, you know, taking care of your family or, you know, your community. It was seamless with, you know, like things like cooking. You know, it was so you wouldn't call it this other thing. You wouldn't call it medicine. You would just call it, you know, part of all that, you know, integrated family life or community life.
I like that. That's a good example. Yeah, Matthew.
Question. Sort of like make the language train. Were you saying that part of what this quote is talking about is that, just I'm repeating a little bit what you said and asking a question. So from pre-modern to modern, we go from to a system that has an identified structure, something like that is what you said?
An externally imposed structure.
Right, an externally imposed structure.
Externally.
Externally imposed. Externally by...
the West.
Okay, as opposed to... because there always is a structure of some kind, an explanatory structure. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that is imposed by another group, not necessarily the West. But like, you know, one group takes over and then they set up their own.
Sure.
Like this, maybe this could be a West type thing, but when the Romans or the Greeks went and started going through, or when the Mongolians were coming the other direction, they set up their own structure on where they were.
Sure, and I think you could probably make a very similar type of, you wouldn't call it maybe pre-modern to modern, but there is still that same.
But there's always some kind of external structure that is influencing how things happen. So I don't think that that's necessarily, it doesn't seem like to me that that is, that there's a solid case right there for just an externally imposed structure is what's going on.
Does it help if we rein it back into medicine? Because that's really, you know, again,
frame it down yet.
Well, yeah, yeah, obviously. I mean, yes, I think I got slightly hyperbolic, but I do really mean that, and I'm not talking about sort of global changes from a pre-modern era to a modern era. I'm talking about within the realm of medicine.
Right, but like even outside Western biomedicine, you have whoever is in charge of doing what one might say what in Western medicine a physician or nurse practitioner or somebody does, that there's an individual who would do that, whether or not they only did that or they did lots of different things, or if it's the older woman in a group who's helping with childbirth, or if it's the person who's
the spiritual guide,
spirits or whatever. There's always something like that. So there's always somebody who has the specialized knowledge.
Oh,
like
true. Yes.
Liver, lung, stomach.
Oh, of course. Yes. There's natural division of labor within every society. But the difference was, is that the person who had that specialized knowledge was still coming from the same cultural, I keep going back to soup, I don't know, I'm hungry. The same cultural, and I can't pronounce milieu very well, of everyone else. You know, so in that sense, and that's the difference. Okay, now I'm going to talk about capitalism. That's the difference between the sort of the pre-capitalist, pre-modern, in which division of labor did not carry such extreme power differentials as it does now in terms of resource accumulation and control over others. So part of this modernity, because he defines it as there's this reign of technical experience.
Okay, that makes more sense.
So it's the technical that comes with Western biomedicine that's coupled with the incredible power of colonialism in this case, and how that all ties together. So yes, in some ways it might look very similar on the surface. You know, I have to walk across town to go to the healer who I pay a couple chickens. That's a hierarchical relationship in which he's arguing fundamentally different for the patient who is experiencing illness than having to walk across town to go to the clinic.
Did you say earlier that like that it something about disembodying as well?
Yes.
And the disembodying is related to that sort of the Western biomedicine bringing the technology and the difference in power, the power differential thing, as opposed to other structures that. The way they set it up, it's like because spiritual things, that's disembodying right there.
The imposition of an outside, oh, like Catholic missionaries?
Oh, that could be it. But I'm also thinking about
or Jesuits, excuse me.
What's the book we read at the beginning last semester?
Spirit Catches You When You Fall Down?
So, like, that you don't have, that you're taken over, you're disembodied in a way, and that's not.
Mm-hmm.
And their understanding of it in a way could be described as disembodying for her from them.
Yes.
That it's not just that Western biomedicine is doing a disembodying thing per se, right?
Right, but medicine we're pulling out as an exemplar of all these other things that come with it.
Okay.
Is that?
I think so.
Okay. Sorry, guys. All right. Maybe when we move on to the modern, by seeing what comes next, because again, I did, and it's my fault, because he is not concerned with what came before the transition. I had a moment of anthropological imperative to talk about early or non-industrial society people. All right, so the modern period. when you start to have a particular type of knowledge, this reign of technical experience. And think about Unit 1. The modern period, the body as specimen, all of the things we talked about in Unit 1 can be used. Okay, well, don't quote me on all of them. In general, the themes that we talked about in Unit 1 can be used to understand what Frank is talking about when he talks about the modern era of experiencing illness. Again, that's what we're talking about. We're talking about eras of experience, how experience is lived. So it was lived however it was lived, but it was integrated and everybody was fine. Then we start to have this transition where that disembodying imposition of a particular type of knowledge and bodily control, in which pain no longer carries extra physiological meaning, almost. This idea that pain goes into symptoms in a way that reduces the individual, reduces the particular to the general. We talked about this in Unit 1. You know, that individual variations are gauged against a standard. And the variations, we don't know what to do with those very much. This idea that it's dominated by a medical narrative. So the experience of illness in relation to storytelling, because that's ostensibly why we're here tonight, is a medical narrative. It's a narrative in which the patient surrenders in many ways her voice, meaning her version of the illness, her way of talking about the illness, because it's subsumed under the medical narrative in which pain turns into a symptom. The particular is generalized. And the practitioner becomes the spokesperson for the patient experience. Think of all the things we read about sort of charting, taking histories. What gets institutionalized and validated as a true patient story? It's what's in that chart. What's interesting, and I love this, he says, bullet point. Keeping our traveling metaphor, is it the modern era of experience, people in the modern era of experiencing illness, the way that it is conceptualized is a movement from the land of the sick to the land of the well. You know, that's what happens, I guess, or death. it says, and not, again, not that people aren't having alternative explanations of their illness, but in terms of what is sanctioned, what is validated, what is looked for, what is given credence to, the illness becomes a circulation of stories, professional and lay, but not all stories are equal. And so that's a feature of the modern era, is that power truly starts to be important here. And he says that in modernity, we didn't question this. He said the benefits were immediate. And I think we all know what that means. You know, the idea that if you enter into a clinic environment with a particular health problem, this way of turning your pain into a symptom was the way that the practitioner could then diagnose and treat you. And you get to leave. He said, the benefits were immediate and the cost not yet apparent. So that if you're just looking at acute problems, this reign of technical experience is exactly what you want. Or you'll suffer it as a temporary indignity, as we'll talk about later. And that's when he says it's when we shift from the acute to chronic care that we see a transition to a postmodern era. Postmodern in the sense of, not postmodern, an era in the sense of how people are telling stories about their illness experiences. And he's going to really focus on this idea of chronic illness, or even whoever said it before, on some level, this idea that we're all pre-ill, and with genetic testing, this could play. He doesn't talk about it, but one could. You know, that with genetic predispositions, are you considered chronic from birth? So the modern to the postmodern. Benefits, I love that. The benefits were immediate and the cost not yet apparent. It's only when a group of people with chronic illness took the voice, took the experience, recognized that there was something either not right, not comfortable, not validating, not fulfilling, too disembodying, and reclaimed, I think he would argue. Here we go. The modern to the postmodern. Jeff, can you read this in a booming loud voice?
Telling stories of illness is the attempt, instigated by the body's disease, to give a voice to an experience that medicine cannot describe. This voice is embodied in a specific person, but it is equally social, taking its speech from the postmodern times we live in. The voice of the ill person is made possible by the modernist medicine, but it cannot be contained within modernist assumptions.
This is key.
I'm pronouncing that right.
I would say modernist. But this,
yeah.
The voice of the ill person is made possible by modernist medicine. What does that mean? Very simply. It means you get to be alive long enough. You get to get through your illness. We'll talk about the remission society. I love that. The voice of the ill person is made possible by modernist medicine, but it cannot be contained within modernist assumptions. Okay, continue.
Particularly those about medical professional dominance and the narrative surrender this dominance requires. A divide has been crossed into new territory. We know this crossing by the new voices that are heard. Sorry, I was reading those. Trying to get an understanding while I'm reading.
Yeah, no. And what's really interesting, and one of the women who's going to be here tonight, Mary Walton, who's an alum of our program, who's leading the patient-centered and family-centered care movement at HUB, a lot of these initiatives are being spurred lately across the country. And some of the arguments are, well, hospitals are ranked now by patient satisfaction, so how can we make patients more satisfied, you know, include them in the decisions, include the families, yada, yada, yada. All probably true. But also, again, given the interrelatedness of cultural systems, so we have an economic argument. And here is sort of the more anthropological, philosophical argument for why this movement may be happening now. It's something distinctive about the postmodern experience of illness, an experience that cannot be contained within modernist medicine, as an impetus to try to start changing what medicine, how it may be conceptualized. And I find this incredibly fascinating.
Next question.
Yes.
Or maybe very broad question. So this, the voice of the ill person is made possible by modernist medicine. I don't understand that, or I don't buy it. Like, there wasn't, like, the ill person didn't have a voice before modernist medicine was there. I mean, it's sort of like if a tree falls in the forest, you know, just...
See, I don't believe it makes a sound. I came to that conclusion last year, and I'm sticking to it.
I'm not arguing this.
You mean if no one hears it, it doesn't make a sound? Or?
You know, what
if nobody's in the forest, the tree does not make a sound. Yes. Which is so funny, because then Autumn was like, yes, it does. So what about Olivia's point? Does this statement, the voice of the ill person is made possible by modernist medicine, how do you understand it? Do you buy it? Do you disagree with it? How do you interpret that statement? Casey?
I don't know. That's the part I thought I got them out. The tree. Sorry. Turned me off, to be honest.
Yeah, stop. Don't even...
No, I mean, like, aren't people not, like, living long enough to, like, talk about their illness? Or?
I took a lot of it just at that level. Yes. Part of it I took it as the being...
But not every illness is terminal.
Oh,
I
you
kind of like that in the
But... Whatever, these deaths would have been related to the illness, and they wouldn't have been like talking about the illness. They would just be talking about the other people would be talking about death. So, and that's their voice is silenced. Like, either way.
No, I want to keep going because I'm fascinated by it, because this is one of those things that I just read over and I was like, well, of course. So, which doesn't necessarily mean that I am right, but yeah.
I don't know if I'm completely off base, but it almost seems like pre-modern, going back to what that woman said, they knew they were sick. They didn't know what, why, how, or whatever. Modern advances, the modern age, gave words and names and meanings to what they were sick with. But in a sense, though, what I sensed as I was reading this was that kind of picture was that what their personal story was taken away by modern medicine, and postmodern medicine is bringing the voice back to the patient to speak as a person. So maybe there was, you know, they were ignorant or had no voice as far as understanding what they had. Modern medicine gave voice, gave words and meaning to what they had, but they lost that old world personal story where you got sick, you stayed at home, you lived your illness with your family, your story, your experience as a person was there. Modern medicine takes that away. You're put in a clinical environment, you're seen by doctors. I think even in the story they talked about how the doctor ends up becoming the chronicler of the illness, because everything is put in the doctor's notes, and the only thing that the family knows or the person's able to tell is the little bit they communicate with their family while they're there. But now with postmodern approach, the person's voice is reunited with themselves. That's the way I was seeing it, but maybe I'm way off.
Mm-hmm. Remember that too. No, I like. We're not just talking about a symbolization. A diagnosis. We're not just talking about the voice of the voice of articulating a what and a how. We're talking about the voice in terms of the voicing of the experience of living with an illness.
Right.
In context, as it's felt and lived and embodied. So.
Isn't he saying, though, that the postmodern period is giving that back to patients? Isn't that what he's saying? And that the modern age kind of took that away?
Not. I mean, obviously, it didn't take it away. It didn't take it away in the sense of there was no forceful taking it away. We're sort of back in the sort of hegemonic idea that if, and this is probably why you have a problem with it, because you are personally embedded in a alternative framework for looking at the human body. So put your anthropological eyes on. Because I think... maybe Sylvie's got it.
Not very
down. Oh, it's not that people took away the stories... But it's just there was no sanctioned official space in the official narrative for those stories.
Right, that's, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay, kind of like that.
Okay.
It's a little different, too. I was going to say that it destabilizes the assumption that everyone experiences illness the same.
Oh.
And so it's no longer generalizable, which is what, like, modernism kind of does.
People make the analogy like Fordism, assembly lines.
Yeah.
You know, that's part, you can tie that in there as well.
Right, and so then it like emphasizes the uniqueness of the individual bodily experience and the social context and the time and place of where they are. So I just keep coming back to that.
Yes, and that's good. It's perfect.
Okay.
Yes.
All
right. We do have to move on, but I will post these slides. And if I don't, remind me again. I double booked my parents yesterday. That's how busy I am. And how they're in town, and I was like, oh yeah, I can go to that meeting at 8:30 on Wednesday morning. And then my mom and dad were in town for a day, and they're like, so can you pick us up at 8:30 to take us to the train station? I was like, crap. So remind me if I forget to post it. Okay. Let's look at what these postmodern sickness stories are all about. And this might indicate, this first quote, kind of what we're talking about here. The loss of a life's map and destination are not medical symptoms. They don't fit in the modern storytelling environment. At least until some psychiatric threshold is reached. I love that. It's just because it's saying that all of the stuff, because when we were all nodding our heads and going, yes, chronic illness, unexplained illness, incurable illness, these take away an individual's map and destination. They're disembodying, they're dismooring, they're all of these other things. Because there's no place for that in modern medicine unless it reaches a psychiatric threshold. So the key to stories in this post-modern illness world, the empowerment, or the post-illness, I guess, in the chronic stage, in this period in which you are effectively well but never cured, as Frank calls it, this remission society, which is a nice metaphor there for what that is. And here again, he's saying it's made possible by modern medicine, so maybe we do have to just take him at sort of face value that modern medicine was what enabled someone to be chronically ill, as opposed to dead. But that this experience of living in a remission society is made intelligible by postmodern times. That the journey, instead of a journey from the land of the sick to the land of the well, is a fluid journey. A liminal type journey. Remember, we've used this word liminal before. You're not one, you're not the other, you're kind of in the middle. You think, sort of, he says, think of a demilitarized zone. Think of a permanent visa status. And he even says this, think of those screensavers in which like one photograph morphs into another and it lives as a photograph for a second and then starts to morph into the next one. That fluidity is what he's talking about as sort of analogies to thinking about what storytelling, how we can make these experiences intelligible in these more fluid terms. Because the binary, well, the sick terms of medicine don't work for the real lived experiences of living in a demilitarized zone or with a permanent visa. And then he goes into a very brief discussion, but interesting discussion about this idea that some people like to talk about chronic illness as sort of a colonial, or like to talk about the modern era as sort of a colonial era, and saying, well, maybe we're not just postmodern, but we're also post-colonial. And he's just using that idea of, in the same way as post-colonial societies did, the demanding and the taking of a voice, the demand, you know, sort of the reclamation of something that once was there, which I think, Sam, somebody said, you know, that sort of the pre-modern and the post-modern share a lot of characteristics. And I thought it was interesting. I wanted to think about that some more. And he says, for those of us with modern illnesses, an acute illness, where you do travel from well, the land of the sick to the land of the well, he says, medical colonization is only a temporary indignity. But that it can be, in the same way as colonialism was, incredibly harmful to the person being colonized. What do you guys think of that analogy? And maybe part of it is a generational thing, that if, I think, what did Frank write this in the 90s? If things like patient-centered movements are on the rise, and if more and more people are living with postmodern illnesses and telling postmodern illness stories, illness narratives, then this idea of being colonized by a modern illness may make less sense versus how it may have made sense to our grandparents. Yes.
Can we throw an example out with that? Like, so strep throat.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a modern illness because, well, yeah, because if it progresses and you don't get antibiotics, you get scarlet fever, and as a kid, you can die.
Mm-hmm.
But you give penicillin and it goes away.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be a modern illness.
Yeah.
In a sense, right? Mm-hmm. Or syphilis because.
Yeah.
Is that chronic though? In a way, until you die.
Yeah, there's not hard lines. It's fluid.
Yeah, so what is the colonization, though?
Mm-hmm.
I think I might be. What about statin drugs? Would that be a good example of colonization of modern medicine? So you're diagnosed with having high cholesterol, and you literally have to make a decision to be tied forever for the rest of your adult life to modern medicine and to a drug that maybe has, as even was released last week, you know, huge spikes in, you know, severe, I forget which, type diabetes as a result of long-term users of statin drugs. So would that be an example of that?
It would be for somebody, I think Frank would say, that is an example of a postmodern illness because it is medicine keeping you going on some level, or you made the decision to have that. But that if you are a modernist person yourself and that story makes sense in your life, then he would say, yeah, you know, you're sort of in a state of medical colonization because they're the ones who are dictating the prescription, the distribution, the pricing, the how many times you have to go back to the doctor, do you have to keep getting a referral? That's sort of the idea of being under a medical colonized system. And the stories that you would tell under that system are very biological and physiological. It would make sense with that. And again, it's not a distinction between illnesses. It's how the illness is experienced in many ways. Because some people may find that oppressive. But not just find living with the condition oppressive, but find oppressive the lack of alternatives within the system.
Sure.
So that
or
if,
medical side effects to those drugs, you know.
Okay, yeah, I'm just so on the experience level.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So he's saying for someone who has to temporarily arrange their lives according to the medical system, like, I mean, strep throat is sort of one visit-y type of thing. you know, but it's, so, minor, I mean, and I think that's what he's saying. You know, it doesn't...
So appendicitis.
Okay, that's a
good
one.
You go in, you have the surgery, hopefully it's fine, then you, after a few days, you're gone.
I like that example better, because it...
Okay.
His argument does lose strength when you do talk about things like headaches. Right. I mean, obviously chronic headaches and migraine headaches, but right. I mean, just an average sinus headache. So yes, appendicitis. You are temporarily colonized by the system. And he says it's temporary indignity because in that case, you don't care that someone else is telling your story.
Right.
You don't care that you have to live according to someone else's time frame. All that phenomenology of illness... We talked about with chronic pain last week, but we talked about how you could use those 7 or 8 elements of phenomenology, this idea of who controls my time, who controls my movement through space. A temporary indignity, and whether or not we actually think it's an indignity probably is varied. How much we choose to care about it varies as well. And keep in mind, Arthur Frank... And again, this is maybe it's because as a lot of academics are getting older and they're getting chronic illnesses, they're writing about this more. He had, was it a heart attack? Or it was a heart attack, it wasn't a stroke. And then he had undiagnosed for many years some sort of cancer, prostate cancer maybe? Testicular cancer? And then lives in a state of chronic pain from the cancer treatments. So that's important to keep in mind too. So he is concerned with people like him, people who have had a fundamental change in their embodiment due to living in this remission society. That's why he says, I'm, you know, effectively well, but I'm never cured. Okay. So the postmodern experience of sickness, the postmodern impetus to tell a particular type of story can't exist in the modern clinic. It has to exist outside of the clinic. Unless you're talking about sort of these new agey, newfangled, you know, I guess maybe help, I don't know. You know, where art therapy is encouraged and movement therapy is encouraged and alternative forms of healing are encouraged, that would allow for that liminal fluidity, all that kind of stuff. But in general, he's arguing that stories are being told outside the clinic, among communities, to either strangers in the form of art exhibits or novels, or to family members and other ill sufferers. The Radley piece, which is not the one I posted, but is another Radley piece I've used in the past, talks also about storytelling and how it has an impact on its listener. And talks about how what makes stories impactful for the listener is how they start with this moment of what he calls horror. And the horror is not necessarily the what that is told, but it's sort of the how it's told, the how the horror happens, how the diagnosis happens. He calls it the appearance of the unthinkable in the guise of the innocuous. So something like returning, and I think this is a Frank story that he's writing about. Frank talks about returning, or maybe, I don't know, returning to his hospital room and seeing the new sign on his door that read lymphoma, a diagnosis that he had not yet been given. So in that sense, it's like, it's not just the diagnosis of lymphoma that is the horror, it's the way that the diagnosis was learned about. another example from this other piece, and I'll find it and post it, is a patient who, before you sort of get into the pre-op instruction, you know, sort of the workup and the talking about the future with for a tongue cancer operation, and the hospital dentist explains that there's a particular gel that the patient has to rub on his gums once his salivary glands have been removed. Patient, and the dentist says, you'll need to rub the gel into your gums every night. For how long? Oh, you know, the rest of your life. That's a moment of horror, he says, that we can all relate to. He calls it a transmutation of feeling. That's why I stopped assigning this article. but the idea that the horror lets us connect. There's something, what did he call it? The appearance of the unthinkable in the guise of the innocuous. And then he gets into this idea of the aesthetic, because he's reinforcing that it's not what the story is, but it's how the story is told. And this is Frank. I want to spend our last 45 minutes talking about the ethics of telling stories. The fact that the stories are being told elsewhere is in large part where the ethical implications come into play. Some people, he says, would argue that, you know, if we're talking about stories in this postmodern era, you can't talk about a postmodern ethics of telling stories. Because, as and he cites Alan Wolfe, but a lot of people who critique postmodernism do sort of go with the simplest, sort of best soundbite sort of understanding of postmodernism. If you believe that postmodernism is a state in which nothing is eternal, all value is relative, meaning is self-referential, and the sacred is little more than an ideological construct imposed by those who hold the power over those who lack it, he says, how can you have an ethics? But think of what he's thinking. It's evident what he's thinking ethics is. He's thinking ethics in the sense of a normative, modern ethics in which ethics is designed to help a person figure out what to do. And in the case of medical ethics, who is that person under consideration? The practitioner. We don't have medical ethics introductory seminars for patients when they get admitted. So is it, where would then, a, what is a, what is, where does a postmodern ethics lie? What does it look like? What is it? And he says it does not exist in these, he calls it intellectual trends. I don't know if he'd say established disciplines. I don't know what he would say. But it exists at the level of the individual. And I think this is why I'm so drawn to it as an anthropologist who is most concerned about individuals, how they move through the world, how they interrelate to other individuals, and how they make sense of it. So I think there's something, for those of you who are drawn to an anthropological perspective, there's something interesting about this postmodern ethics as Frank is talking about it. And he has, I didn't put it up here, because I need to look at it some more. Is that Joyce? Is it Joyce? Quote? And then, of course, I didn't write down the page number. He says it was the best. He doesn't. Oh, I need a word, sir. Oh, here we go. Page 17.
James, not Joyce. The status of, I'm at the bottom of 16, the status of personal responsibility is a central moral issue for postmodernity. No particular standard, the cynical divide in response to the demise of truth. An alternative was expressed at the beginning of the century by William James, whose prescient modernism may have already crossed the postmodern divide. One of his letters is the finest epigram I have found to the particular assumption of responsibility that is equally a potential of postmodern times. I am convinced that the desire to formulate truths is a virulent disease. It has contracted an alliance lately in me with a feverish personal ambition, which I never had before, and which I recognize as an unholy thing in such a connection. And then I need to think a lot more about that. I actually dread to die until I have settled the universe's hash in one more book. Unless he's saying that that's sort of his feverish personal ambition taking over. Child, maybe that is, and he's criticized him. Child, this idiot, as if formulas about the universe could ruffle its majesty, and as if the common sense world and its duties were not eternally the really real. I see a lot of a much more eloquent here explanation of the difference between bodies of knowledge that seek truth and bodies of knowledge that seek to pay attention to the quote-unquote really real. And it's that sort of very crude analogy that I gave of the sort of Plato's cave. You know, I care about how the people interact with the shadows. I don't care as much about what causes the shadows.
I think this is a big issue with politicians and politicians is that they obsess too much about what's true, what's not true, what's a lie, what's not a lie, when really it's a process that should be internalized by experience in art and literature. And it's natural. It's not something you have to intellectually mastery over.
Okay.
Because metaphor is the more complex, the bigger the lie, but also the more meaning that's contained within them. And when you break things down to very simple black or white, is it true, is it not, it's not the same as reading Don Quixote, books like that to figure out meaning, placing them on a lineage of history and philosophy.
Mm-hmm. So then your challenge, and this, if you want to address it in a log, that would, it was slightly off topic, but if you tied it into medicine, I think that would be fine, is...
Well, it's tied into medicine because doctors, I mean, right now...
No, I just mean don't talk about politicians in general, but talking about sort of this is the challenge to take.
Criticize like end of life decisions.
No, this is the challenge. The challenge is to not answer the questions, but put an anthropological, analytical eye on the phenomenon. So that's step one. Nobody, although it is tempting as all hell to do this, I do it all the time. But I try to do it just over my dinner table. And as witty asides while I'm teaching. But is not to make sort of the judgments and the, this is, you know, they should be doing this and this is the wrong way to do it. It's to find the slinky of the phenomena that you're interested in and then see how you tie it into other phenomena. So that idea about politicians dumbing things down, which they all do to greater or lesser degrees, to looking for black and white and the absolute truth may very well be a modernist mode of governing.
I think I discussed this in my paper. I know it's very late.
Oh, it's fine.
Yeah.
Late's fine. So the challenge is always, how do I take what I'm interested in and the opinions that I have? And because opinion writing can be powerful. It can be incredibly, I can't think of a synonym to powerful. But if you want other academics to listen to you, the opinion has to be so expertly woven into your conclusions, and you have to show how you got there. So that's the challenge, is to sort of, you can use these logs. You know, what theory am I going to use? How am I going to use that theory to find the data to get to my opinion? Okay, so the Joyce quote, where does the postmodern ethics lie? It may lie in the really real of the individual. And so then Frank takes, James is talking about the, you know, distilling the universe's hash. To settle the universe's hash is to place oneself outside the vulnerability and contingency that being in the universe involves. The intellectual infected with such an ambition ceases to think of himself as a body, thus disclaiming the vulnerability that bodies share. Ceasing to think of oneself as a body severs a connection that is fundamental to thinking of oneself as a person who exists for other people. So we can kind of start to see how, if paying attention to who we are as people, embodied people, and how we exist with and for and from, you know, other people, putting ourselves in that relationship, as sort of a postmodern ethical way of looking at illness, it relates, you know, I think the reason, I have a big grand conclusion, but I'm too soon, and I don't want to, it has to do with the, sorry, I'm also simultaneously in my head right now writing this lecture I have to give on Friday about this. You can give me feedback. To a whole bunch of doctoral PT students. I want to instill this idea that paying attention to narrative and stories gives us access to a very different and distinct view of patients. And it's hard not being a practitioner myself. I realize that I have a theoretical leg to stand on, but not a practical leg to stand on. But since we've already convinced them over the past few weeks, the value of the principles of solidarity and social justice, which I think I got them there, then you have to then go with sort of this idea of an ethics being more interpersonal. They're related and they have to go together. You can't have an ethics that is only founded upon beneficence, non-malfeasance, autonomy, and justice if you are going to consider illness in a postmodern way. It's a lot harder to make those connections. In large part because, let's go back to the embodiment. He says he doesn't know, you know, he doesn't like this idea of talking about what is a true story, which we all want, you know, we see that all the time. Well, what's the truth? What's the real story here? What's really going on? In the same way that we talked about last week, we can't underestimate the power of telling the correct story. Similar here, because he said, if we're going to talk about something that's a true story, by necessity then it sort of implies that there is something called that is a false story. And he would disallow that. He said there are no false stories. He says even that we are, and it's a perfect embodied perspective, that when someone in their story is evasive, or seems to be evasive or away from around the truth, the more powerful the truth of the desire for what is being told is the corrected version of what was lived. And this, there may be some typos in there, but I think they came from the chapter. The copy editor wasn't very good. But this idea that the act of lying, The act of evading the truth, the act of telling a story in a particular way, which may be seen by others as not true or evasive, is simply a representation of who that embodied person, what is important for them, their postmodern story.
Yes, but even in a world where the thicker the mask, the more menacing the villain, and you're criminalized or considered a criminal for like making complex metaphors out of things. And sorry, I reverted back to the domination book I mentioned before, but it's if you create a narrative that's so ridiculous and then get in a car accident and accidentally kill someone or something happens, it can be held against you in a way that it's not worth it.
I'm talking about narratives of the self more and sort of the embodied experience of illness. Less so stories
that it's put in a medical record. And those records are become, I don't know, all information that you give out about yourself comes back to bite you, I guess. I don't know.
Comes back to reflect upon you?
To reflect upon you, yes, but yeah. I mean, if you look at people in the public eye, the cameras are destabilizing force. Where having your leg showing can destroy your career and make people not like you. Like Angelina at the Oscars.
Well, yeah.
That's been a great story. Sorry, go ahead,
I do, yes, I will. With only half an hour, I'm not sure I can weave us back, so I'm just going to go on. Coming back to this idea of the challenges of thinking with stories, you know, so I think, the illness through stories, not just thinking about stories. So if we think about stories, if the way we think about stories is sort of just about them, it reduces the story to content. You know, what is this story telling me? That's thinking about the story. But, and then we would analyze that content. Versus taking the story as already complete. Taking the story as an entity into itself, not as a documentation of what we're really interested in. And he says, we can think about sort of an ethics of thinking with stories is to look for the effects of stories on others. Again, whether or not it's an other that you're directly interacting with, the other that you put your message in the bottle, he says, for those of you who are familiar within sociology and anthropology, this idea of witnessing, you know, sort of that there is an ethical responsibility to being present in moments of illness for people who are privileged enough to be there. And so Frank talks about this. This is his last chapter of his piece. Because what he's talking about is an ethics of stories is bringing the writer and the reader into a new relationship with each other. That illness accounts lay at the threshold between where the author gains a sense of coherence and freedom through the sort of empowerment that we've been talking about, and the reader is able to grasp that suffering and its potential. And that witnessing is the social aspect of an ill person's story. I hope to show that in listening for the other, we listen for ourselves. The moment of witness in this story crystallizes a mutuality of need when each is for the other. Okay. So I will leave the last paragraph. Let's spend the next 6 slides taking this from a theoretical level and putting it into a practical level. That sometimes can help see, sometimes I bring it back to the practical, you can see the theoretical a little bit better. And I think in some ways, and again, it's probably not perfect, but the Lawrence piece about the photo voice with survivors of brain trauma, brain injury, is an interesting lived practice of a lot of the theories that, that Frank talks about in terms of the ethics of storytelling, the ethics of engaging others with their stories. And she talks about voice in a tripartite way. It resonated with me in the same way that Howell talks about technology. Technology is not just the thing. The voice is not just the story. And the technology is the knowledge that was created at the situations in which it was used and the effects that it has. Voice is the life expertise and knowledge that is being expressed, the process of constructing meaning from those life experiences, and the act of communicating that experience and constructed meaning to others. And we could even then circle that back, you know, and say, and those new constructed meanings get thrown into the pot through which other people can pull to tell their stories. So it's a small study. 8 members of a brain injury survivor support group. And it was presented as sort of an extracurricular activity of this group of, a larger group of brain injury survivors. And she said it was a very fluid group. You know, people could attend for a year, some attended for a longer period of time. You could come and go. But there were 8 who took her up on the opportunity to plan and participate this research study. And she said that their motivations for doing so were to further their personal healing. One of the examples she gives in terms of involving the participants in the design of the study was even, you know, showing the for those of you who, did everybody read this one? It was short, probably simple. Wait. Give cameras to brain injury survivors with a series of questions, you know, photo document your environment. And they had a series of 8 questions. You know, here's some guides when you're thinking about what you might want to take pictures of. The pictures may answer some of these questions. And one of the questions talked about something about a recovery. And the participant said, recovery implies this, you know, same thing, this modern idea that we will eventually move to the land of the well. We're never going to move to the land of the well. So let's talk about healing and the process, the lifelong process of healing, as opposed to sort of a curing. So many of the things, the problems that I have with a lot of qualitative studies with other groups were addressed here. You know, participation from the participants in the design of the study. The idea that let's know what our public presentation of this is going to be, you know, and tailor it to that. We all think we have to be really creative. On some level, yes, the study was very creative and very interesting, but on some level it was very simple. We know we want to put together a poster. We know we want to put together an exhibit. We know we want to maybe publish an article so we can share this with other people. And in the process, let's see how it helps our motivational goals, our stated motivations of personal healing. For those of you who did look at the link for the visual, the imaging, or the pain exhibit, the online pain exhibit, this struck me very similarly in terms of how thinking about living with an illness sort of seems to divide itself up into very similar types of categories. Lost dreams, journeys, challenges, strategies. The problem, and it's the problem with a lot of qualitative research, is identifying, she says, identifying concrete project impact on healthcare policy and clinical practice remains elusive, however. So again, I'll put out that call. If anybody ever finds any article that shows a direct link between some sort of qualitative study, some group of men somewhere in Washington making a decision, and some policy change on the ground, pay $100. Okay. So, I don't know. What time is it? Okay, we have 25 more minutes. But I do want to talk about the chambers and the narrative piece. My goal for putting this Lawrence piece in there, though, was to really provide a concrete example of how the theories of fluidity, of incontainability of a story within a modernist framework of, you know, clinical diagnosis, clinical treatment, and then now you're in sort of a support group. You're in the land of the remission society here, sort of. And they say it was very high functioning sort of brain injury, so that does change the equation a little bit. But I thought it illustrated a lot of that idea of what does a postmodern illness story look like. And I like the fact that it's a facilitated story, that it's really a, and she's very reflexive about this, where she said, here's what I wanted to do. They told me no. All right, I agreed, and I did it, you know, the other way. Other times, she shows where she maintained her voice. But that idea of interaction on a level plane between subject and participant, I think is also indicative of this sort of postmodern, the family-centered, the patient-centered focus. Similar trajectories running through illness now. So but before I click the slide and go over to Chambers and narrative, did anybody want to talk about other aspects of this Lawrence piece? Okay. Chambers points out that there is a rise now in the academy. So here's the sort of, you know, that the Frank and the other types of pieces have talked about a rise in popular culture, for lack of a better term, of postmodern illness stories. And Chambers says, you know, we're also talking more and more about narrative within ethics proper. You've got narrative ethics programs. You've even got sort of master's degrees now that are focused primarily on narrative ethics. So that there's this rising level of attention to how stories can help us analyze the moral problem. But he says there's a problem here, because what we are, this is more akin to thinking about stories. He even, is it Ruth Cowan that he sort of, you know, sort of one of the mothers of narrative ethics, and even says, if you look come to the end of her more seminal article, she ends with, and you know, stories can really help ethics and contribute to the field of bioethics and recommend actions for bioethics. He says what we want to be doing is looking take a different lens and say, how is narrative theory vital to moral theory itself? Not just how can narrative help us understand what we would have been thinking about anyway, but how does narrative fundamentally change how we think about the endeavor of bioethics? Does that distinction make sense? No? That you have sort of one school of thought that says stories are great because they help us figure out what exactly is the moral problem. They help us figure out contingencies. They may help us figure out possible actions. They may help us figure out how we think about a problem so that when we see it in the real world, you know, we'll be prepared to deal with it. That's one way. He's saying, no, that we have to think about stories and rhetoric and narrative as being inherent to how we have come to have ethical stances and perspectives, how we have come to think about the endeavor of ethics. That there is a particular way in which they function rhetorically within the field of bioethics, which reinforces and perpetuates a particular type of ethics. He says, we're paying attention to narrative not so that we can better analyze a case or write better cases, but because it allows us to be critical of the evidence used to test moral theories. In the same way that we can't separate out mind from body, I think he's saying we can't separate out form from content of stories. We can't focus just on the content of the story. That's just like focusing on that disembodied Cartesian head. That you have to pay attention to the form of the story, the endeavor, the rhetorical strategies of the story, the traditions of the story, and to understand sort of how bioethics is recreating itself. This will become clear as we go through. He gives a case. which we don't need to read it because it's like every single other bioethics case you've ever read. Most likely. Maybe not. I may have come across a really good one. So he takes... Chambers takes this case because Childress uses this case. The Childress of the principles of bioethics, Childress. And his book has, or articles, he'll have different cases, and we'll run through different ways of thinking about ethics to try to see, well, what does a virtue ethics, how does a virtue ethics perspective help us come to a decision about what to do here? And Chambers says that Childress says, you know what, virtue ethics, through the study of motivation, is not valuable here because it offers us no help. And then he moves on to like another form of ethics. Chambers is like, well, of course not. The motivations are left out of the story. So it's not that virtue ethics is bad or is not applicable or cannot be used for this case or doesn't get us anything. It's that the structure, the rhetorical structures of case telling, leave out the motivations of the players. It leaves out the data, so to speak, that that type of ethicist would want. This is completely acontextual. So we notice we fail in this story to see the teller. There's no voice really here. It's a disembodied voice. We also, where does this story start? Usually very late in the true story of an illness. That case is a modern case study. It's a modern story. Hopefully, some part of all of these past 3 weeks have convinced you that there's something valuable to the postmodern embodied experiential storytelling of ill people. And, as Robin pointed out, or Lauren, sorry, the family members around them, the people that are impacted by that illness, those stories are intertwined. It's sort of this idea of we are embodied also by because of the people around us. So of course they have to be implicated in the story, and the illness story affects them.
What's really funny is this is what shamanism was. Like, shamans told stories, and we look at that as like witch medicine, yet somehow we created this new body of healthcare that...
My gut is saying that I think that's...
No.
It's interesting to talk about shamans and storytelling, but that we're talking about it because we are talking about sort of people... Postmodern people that, well, okay.
Well, we completely created something new and didn't build up from what used to be, I guess. Isn't everything like a deconstruction and reconstruction? It just keeps expanding out and inward. And
spirals.
What?
Spirals. Okay, I'm on a roll. I'm going to keep going. There's no teller, failed to see an ethics case. Postmodernism, implications of others, all of these things should play a role. That it's not just plot, there's character. And it makes sense within the field or the discipline of ethics is that when looking at philosophical approaches, really part of the goal is how do we decide what is the ethical action and what action should be taken next. So what he says is we need to attend to the way decisions about the discourse of a narrative, how that influences the kind of moral theories that are judged relevant to it. Let's break down what he means by narrative influences, and I think those will make it perfectly crystal clear how limited bioethics storytelling is. And if the storytelling is limited, then our ethical theorizing about the experience of illness, I think I'm comfortable arguing, is also limited. Why do I keep offering these anthropology classes? Okay, so narrative attributes that show us what is missing. this idea of a the filter, the mediating function of a character's consciousness, the character's perceptions, cognitions, emotions, as experienced from within the story. This is, you know, this idea that he sort of started with. The narrative doesn't or can't reveal the characters, how the characters understand, discern the events. The notion of reportability. What counts as an ethics case? What counts as a story worth telling? When are we going to start telling this story? A story only becomes an ethical story, only becomes a case once the medical dilemma, again, dilemma for who? A dilemma for the provider, comes in. So the problem with cases too, as contrasted to sort of this postmodern illness experience storytelling, is the way that it handles closure. You know, it's the genre of a mystery novel. You know, you know the closure when you know who did it and you know the clues that led the person to figure out who did it. That cases often are left open, leaving the reader to create their own closure by writing the ending. So that's one way that you can have closure. The reader, the analyst, supplies the closure. The story gives an ending, but the closure happens only when the reader analyzes it and either rewrites it for the more ethical path to take, or comes and says, yes, I think this was the appropriate action to take. That's closure. The rhetorical strategies of characters in case studies and case stories, that it's action-focused versus character-focused. He gives the great example of comparing a Grisham novel to a Virginia Woolf novel. And I love mystery novels, but it is true. The characters are almost interchangeable. In the same way that the particulars have gone to the general in modern medicine, the particulars are going to the general in a bioethics case study. Not a lot of space for character development in cases. And some of you are probably thinking, well, yeah, but you have to only fit on a page because you got to have a case book and you got to like present it. You know, this is the way medicine works. Again, no. Criticism is designed to point out the viability and the possibility of alternatives. Nothing is inevitable. So this general nature of the characters leads to a structuralist approach that is designed to help decide on what action to take. I mentioned the chronotype, which is basically sort of this idea of time. I think this is where he gets into that whole TikTok. You know, that's how stories have a sort of a rhythm to them. That the rhythm of case studies is focused on the clinic and the clinic time. Again, where does this case start? It starts at the moment when a dilemma presents itself and a decision has to be made. So the time is also sped up to match clinic time, the freneticness. And I need to think more about when he gives that sort of gendered example, that to what extent is linearity and plot drivenness a male characteristic? So what would a more feminine gendered or, I don't know, LGBT gendered type of story, how would that look? And it's interesting that he doesn't give an example there, because I think he's thinking theoretically about there may be something to this. You know, he's responding. He's very. He writes a lot with the feminist bioethicists. So what's the point? The point is, such literary knowledge for, you know, attention to these rhetorical devices, what they include and what they leave out, permits us to see the contingent nature of ethics and to be aware of how we cannot easily create a boundary between form and content. So, I threw back up here this idea of this embodied ethics and, you know, settling the hash and in disembodying yourself and taking yourself out of personal relationships. To get to this Leuteniemi quote, that asks us again, what happens when we hear stories? We can't know who someone else is, he says. We can only ask ourselves, who did I become after meeting you? How did I change from my experience with you? What did you teach me? you could argue that's very sort of navel-gazing, but it can also be very ethical and very informative, going back to the idea of witnessing and highlighting the interactions among people and realizing that their stories cannot be contained in the modernist clinic. That's all I got. Yeah.
I think the notion of witnessing versus just watching has an underlying sense of responsibility.
Yes. You're similar to sort of the Rosemary Garland Thompson stuff, sort of the ethics of the looking versus staring versus seeing versus bodies in space. Yeah, and I think that's what she and a whole bunch of these other types of theorists are trying to do. They're trying to say that when we look or when we stare and when we don't engage ourselves in a relationship between thinking about two people, we're just sort of eyes looking at you. If we ignore all the stuff that Berger taught us with ways of seeing, then there is no responsibility there. And they would argue that there's a problem with that, sort of ethically. So that, you're right, I think looking versus witnessing carries that added responsibility, which is why so many more people are trying to talk about narrative ethics and witnessing among medical and PT and nursing students.
The potential for action, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. What else? There's like 3 more minutes before the group comes in. Okay, so I don't mean this in any way, shape, or form. This is my sort of own personal evolution. As just to end with a criticism of, principle-based, case-based bioethics. I would not be following my own lessons here if I were. I want to embody bioethics. I want to find where bioethics is on that slinky, to understand why it is the way it is, but then also to understand what it leaves out. And by using some of these other theories, of sort of anthropological, social constructionist theories, how we can better the practice of ethics. And I think I used to think we should just throw it all out, the principles, but now I think they should just be amended and added to. So this is by my own personal evolution. I'm no longer quite as... but I think the adding to with these sorts of perspectives and worldviews will not just tack on like two that I would agree with at the end, but would also change how we understand the first four. They would fundamentally change how we understand what is autonomy. They would fundamentally change how we understand what is beneficence. If beneficence is not just a power differential where I choose, where I have to do what is best for you, but is brought down to a mutual relationship, that the principle's there, it's a universal principle, but how we're going to embody that principle, how we are going to live out that principle, is what is different. And this is where people always critique cultural relativists. They say, oh, you think everything is just different everywhere. No, there's cores. But how those cores are expressed in different situations, that's what we care about. Alright. So, that's all I have. We'll see you next week. Hopefully some of you can stay for the career thing.
You can start in this room.
It starts in this room in 15 minutes. Yes. And I just saw a whole bunch of old alums up that I should go say hi to. I should put my shoes back on. I gotta say, I saw lots more eyes lighting up today, which made me really happy. Sometimes I come home from class and go, oh... people were just looking like, I don't buy it, I don't believe it, Tonight I got some...
It's perspective being out there, too.
So, how'd it go? It's over now. 5 minutes a day.
It took 3 years.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. What is this event about? I probably can't say, but I'm curious.
It's a two-part event from 6:45 until about 7:45 or 8. We've brought in 10 alumni who have an MBE degree. A lot of them have other things. They have masters of social work, they have RNs, they're pharmaceutical executives, they're consultants, this kind of thing. Not to say, you know, here's the kind of job in my industry, but to say, here's why I became interested in bioethics, here's how I integrated my bioethics in my sort of life planning, here's how I used it as a tool when I get interviews or when, you know, applying for things. So it's sort of a job fair in the sense of, how do I learn about the possibilities?
Right.
And then once I see the possibilities, how do I go get it?
Okay.
Yeah. And then there's wine and cheese.
Of course.
Okay. For people to ask questions, because it's just going to be, I think everyone's going to have like 7 minutes to kind of tell their story so that the audience can kind of see the different range of stories. And that's why then we're going to wine and cheese, so that people can target their questions
okay.
to the particular group.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, if someone's interested in pharmaceuticals, or someone, if all the questions about pharmaceuticals, but someone's in the background, but I don't want to be a social worker, you know, it's not really fair to, you know, in this way, the social worker can talk to all the social workers and
right.
that kind of thing.
Yeah, I saw that there was a couple social workers,
mm-hmm.
but I probably can't stay.
Oh.
But I might email you and ask you.
Sure. Oh, yeah, hopefully there's flyers out on the table.
Oh, okay.
And it has all their emails on it.
Okay. Well, then
and
perfect.
They've agreed to